This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Book today is titled, Give Yourself Permission to Live Your Life. And our author, joining me from Great Britain, is Priya Rana Kapoor. Priya, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm really thrilled to be here.
This is a book that is 244 pages of permission, I guess. Is there permission slips in here? What is your book about?
Indeed, there are some permission slips in there, but only as a tool. I started writing this book because I wanted to write a book to help people empower themselves. And a friend of mine said to me, what's the one thing that gets into people's way of empowering themselves? And I said, you know what? They don't give themselves permission. So that's really how this book started.
Fabulous. And your background?
Tell about your background
and your skills.
Okay, so I was trained as an MFT, a marriage and family therapist, at the University of Southern California, although I grew up in the UK. So I was doing therapy in the hospital setting for a long time, but then I switched over to coaching because I like the forward focus aspect of coaching. So I integrated that into my practice, and that really sort of holds the foundation for empowerment. So that's where I like working.
Your first chapter deals with why we should give ourselves permission. What is the thing that mostly holds people back from, I guess, relaxing and enjoying life and not being so uptight about moving forward?
Oh, that's actually a lovely question, because what I think is people are mostly afraid. The main thing, number one, is that they're afraid of what other people will think and that they might not succeed, and that, you know, they don't know what's going to happen, so they have uncertainty. And I think the other thing that goes hand in hand with that is that they don't believe in themselves. They don't have self-worth or self-esteem that's strong enough that they're going to be able to move forward and trust themselves to give themselves permission to really live the life that they want to live.
Do you share any personal stories about your personal life that you had to overcome things and get to a point of accepting and giving yourself permission to live?
Certainly. Absolutely. I do share a little bit of that. Even though I'm a coach and a therapist, we were always taught never to really share anything, but we were also taught to share when we thought it was beneficial to the client or the reader in this case. And so I do share my story. I share the story of growing up in London in a really kind of colorful life with a larger than life family and mother and father. Well, it was for me anyhow as a 9-year-old growing up. And I share how I got to a place where I worried so much about what other people thought, specifically my mother and my family, and whether I was doing the right thing or wasn't doing the right thing. So I do share that, and I share how I got to that place. And then I share an event that happened in my life with a wonderful man called Joe Allen, who came to visit me when I'd just been diagnosed with a chronic illness. I wasn't very well, and he sat with me for 4 hours. And at the end of that, I thought, gosh, you know, I must be worth something if he sat with me for that long. And that really was the time that gave me permission to know that I was worthwhile and know that I had to and just was supposed to live the life that I needed to live. So I do share that, but then I go on to share some of my, because I've been working as a coach for nearly a decade now, and so I share some of my client stories, of course, with their permission, permission being the operative word.
Mm-hmm.
And then with all of that, there is a framework, there is a sort of a process called the permission journey that I found. I worked with my clients over and over again on these steps, and I thought, you know what? I'm just going to put this all in a book because then more people can get to it. So that's how it all came about.
You talk about the word freedom. What does that mean? How do you interpret freedom?
Oh, I think freedom for every human being is the ultimate. And I think really the only way we get freedom is from ourselves. We're the only ones that can give ourselves freedom, and that is by changing the way we think about things, changing the way we do things, and not allowing those shackles to hold us back. And really, we have the key. So freedom is within our control no matter what. And yes, of course, horrible things happen to people. You know, Viktor Frankl and things like that, really horrible. But we have the key to open those cufflinks, you know, cuffs and shackles, so we're able to move forward into freedom. And that means living the life that we need to live, the one that is authentic to us. And the one that actually will bring us to a level where we can help the rest of the world and we can help the family around us. But from a place of absolute freedom and from a place of wanting and not from being forced into. Into helping people.
You talk about the permission journey, and you reference mm-hmm. several different locations geographically. Are those areas that you visited, you know, like the Canary Islands and
Sorry,
so on?
Sorry, go on.
Yes.
Well, now that you know, I've not been to the Canary Islands. I'd love to go to the Canary Islands, but certainly the Hawaiian Islands and the Society Islands. Why I did that was just to have a little bit of fun. And also I say that people can choose their own seven destinations just so it can be more personal. This book is really about personal empowerment and bringing people through the back door. I don't want people to have to make these big splashes. There's a lot of empowerment programs out there that are really fantastic, Tony Robbins and things like that. Fantastic. But this book is the primer. I call it the primer to empowerment, coming through the back door, the quiet side. This is for the people that have put everybody else in front of them for so long and they don't really know how to empower themselves. And if they do start making changes, they're worried about what other people will think. This is for those that want to do it quietly. And so I added the journey in and the different locations, the different island groups around the world as sort of inspiration. And so in time, you know, in another book or in some e-courses, we can explore those islands for what they are. But I want people to be able to go on the journey themselves and to experience it the way that is real for them.
Priya, describe the process of writing your book. Did you sit down with a complete outline to begin this process? And if so, how long did it take to complete?
I started with an outline. I started with the idea, and then the Give Yourself Permission came. So then the Give Yourself Permission outline came very quickly. And then I sort of struggled with writing it down in a linear fashion. So I actually did it orally. So I recorded myself in each chapter, just talking about each chapter, and then transcribed that, had someone transcribe that. And then I went through and moved everything around. So that's how I did it, because I actually like communicating verbally and orally better than it's easier for me to get my ideas out that way. And then I'm quite good at editing and disseminating information down. So that's the way I did it.
In your book on chapter 4, you talk about being on the ledge. Was that your personal journey, or was that just a narrative that you wanted to share with people?
No, that was definitely my personal journey. Yeah, that was one of those moments in life when you you know that you're not alone. Well, for me, everybody has their different way, and I connected with myself and my higher power in that place. I tell the story of some medics and some interactions with medication that really made me very, for want of a better word, loopy, where I nearly jumped out of my window. And that was one of the most frightening moments of my life and one of the most pivotal moments where I knew that there was a higher power out there wanting to help, and that there was a lot out there that was bigger than me.
You have a 244-page manuscript and a book and some mm-hmm. instructions. Would you describe this as easy to read, or is this something that an individual will have to spend some time really reflecting on the content?
Well, I wrote it so it would be easy to read. So that's what people have said, that it's easy to read and you can dip in and dip out. I think it's a book definitely, I know it's a book, because other people have said this, that people go back to different points. I didn't want to make the exercises so obvious that you couldn't move forward. I wanted people to sort of read through them at their own pace and come back to them when it was right for them. Because sometimes when I read self-help books and I have to do the exercise and write it in the book, I don't like writing in books. I don't like turning down the pages. You know, that really drives me crazy.
Right.
So there's no place for people to write in the book. It's more reflective. So dip in, dip out, read what you want to. The only reason I put my own story in there because I thought it might help. I certainly don't think anybody has to read it. I think some of the stories of my clients are easy to understand. They're short. People will identify with them. There is a continuity to the book, definitely, but reading it cover to cover is not exclusive. You don't have to do that.
Your book, your chapters build on each other, and towards the end, you're at the, I would say, the inspirational side of the read. Chapter 11, give yourself permission to know your dream team, your foundational dream team. How do you find those?
Yes.
Is that an individual? Is that a concept? What would you say describes that?
Oh, I love that dream team chapter. Those are all the people that have believed in you in the past, so and currently, and people that are an inspiration to you. So there's definitely doing an inventory of the people. So there's three different dream teams. Your foundational dream team, which are the people that have believed in you in the past, and this is like the gentleman that came to visit me, and people that have said, you know, sort of change life-changing things to you, but not they may not have known they were life-changing, but they really struck a chord with you. You had an aha moment,
right.
And you thought, gosh, wow, they believed in me. So it's making an inventory of that. So it's quietly finding those people out, seeking them out, writing it down, keeping it close to your heart. That's what I do, definitely. And so it's sort of honoring them. And then your current dream team are the people around you that can help you. And sometimes you forget about people. So it's really, again, doing an inventory. And then the inspirational dream team are the people that you think are doing a really good job, either in your field or that are good mentors or that are out there doing a good job and that you want to be like. That doesn't mean copying them. That doesn't mean putting yourself up against them. And it means learning from them. So that's what an inspirational dream team member is for me, is finding out about these people that are doing something that you want to do so you can emulate that, but learn from it rather than copy.
You also inspire and challenge the reader because you don't want them to be a taker only. You say you are a dream team member.
Yeah, well, I hope to be, definitely, and that's not for my ego, as it were, but I would hope to help people. I tell a story in the book where I always ask tourists when they're lost around my neighborhood if they need help, and you know, of course, at first they're like, "What does she want?" And then I help them because I like to be helped when I'm in a different city, and so I hope that makes them comfortable and makes them like the City of London, which is, you know, my favorite city in the world, practically. I mean, it is. So I think we have a responsibility in this world to be in other people's dream teams and help other people, whether they acknowledge it or not, is you know, superfluous and redundant.
Great advice. Great advice. Now, in a couple of sentences, introduce this book to someone who doesn't know you.
Oh, my goodness. It's a guide. It's a straightforward guide to taking back your life and getting happiness and ultimate freedom.
What makes your book different from others in the marketplace that deal with motivational ideas to live your life in a better way?
I think what makes it different is it's the quiet side. There's so many, as I call whiz-bang out there, and I've mentioned a few already, which are really good, but this one is for the person that doesn't even know how to start empowering themselves. So as I said, it's a primer, and I introduce the reader. There's a lot in this book, and I introduce the reader to a lot of the different concepts of empowerment so they can go forward and look further into the things that are really important for them or that strike a chord with them. So not everybody's going to identify with everything in the book, but they certainly, I hope, will identify with something that they can look into further and then take ownership of that aspect and go forward. So that's what this book was definitely meant to be, just to sort of spread the information out there so people can make choices for themselves.
In your introduction, you mentioned the words of Anne Frank. The final forming of a person's character lies in their own hands. Great advice. Was there challenges in completing this book?
It's getting started that was the difficulty for me. The challenges, no, actually, it was getting started that was a challenge. Once I got into it, it completely flowed, and it was absolutely what I needed to do. And every day I sat down for hours and hours. I don't think I left the house for about a year and a half. Wow. And I did, but not much, except to see clients. But it was a wonderful experience. But what I really came to find out is that there was a lot. I learned a lot from my clients, and that's why a lot of their stories are in the book, and I was exceptionally grateful for the people around me and the people that I've learned from through my life. And I found it a privilege to be able to share with everybody whilst writing this book. So
your book title is Give Yourself Permission to Live Your Life. Our author, mm-hmm. Priya Rana Kapoor. Priya, where do we get copies of this book?
Well, I have a website, www.gyspermission, so that's Give Yourself Permission, so gyspermission.com. Also, it's available on Amazon and on .co.uk.com, Barnes & Noble, all the usual outlets, and it's in some retail shops now in London, so like Watkins Bookstore, Foyles, and so I'm very excited about having physical copies in physical shops. But otherwise, you can get all the information from gyspermission.com and Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, everything.
Fabulous. Now, is there a sequel in the works?
There might be. Yes, there is.
Tease.
Yes, there is. I think the next one I will write is Give Yourself Permission to Be Spiritual, because I haven't added a lot of that into this book only because of just different reasons of not wanting to put too much into this book, because there's already a lot in there and not wanting to confuse the issues. So that'll be the next one. But I also want to start sort of finding out what other people want to write about, and maybe having a group of writers together on the same vein as Give Yourself Permission.
Kapoor?
Give Yourself Permission,
yes,
to be the parent you want to be, or something like that.
Definitely needed. I've got some family members who would love a book like that right as we are speaking. So hurry up and get that one done. All right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Priya Rana Kapoor has been my guest. The title of her book, Give Yourself Permission to Live Your Life. Thank you, Priya, for joining me today.
No, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Dix of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear the latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
This is Indie Book Publishing, brought to you by Westbow Press. My name is Brian Houston. Today we're talking about a book called Killing the Church, The Failure to Confront. The author of the book is Dr. Jeff Parker, and he's on the phone right now with us from Brandon, Mississippi. Dr. Parker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Brian. It's good to be with you.
Thank you very much for being here with us. Let's talk, before we get into Killing the Church, The Failure to Confront, tell us a little bit about your background as a minister and also a missionary.
Well, I've been in ministry for 35 years. I served as a missionary, Southern Baptist missionary in Zimbabwe, Africa, and then pastored for a short time, again with Southern Baptist International Mission Board in England. I also served as a chaplain in the United States Army, and the last 35 years have been in just a myriad of different kinds of church settings. I've been in primitive villages in Africa that were, they were first hearing the gospel. I pastored a church in England that was on the verge of closing that began to revive and come back to life. And I now serve in Jackson, Mississippi, and have been here for several years in an inner city church where we do all kinds of homeless inner city type ministries, and you know, so I've had a lot of experience in a lot of different kinds of settings, which is kind of unique in ministry.
I want to ask you about this book, Killing the Church, The Failure to Confront. First of all, that's a pretty stark title for a book. So tell me about what inspired you to write this book and what it's about.
Well, I think that a lot of times in pastoring and being in counseling, and I have an earned doctorate, and I've done a lot of counseling through the years, you see people who come to Christ, people who join the church. I've done a lot of marriage counseling, parenting, and this kind of thing, and you know, what often happens is you see people that, as far as their personality, a lot of times they never change. A man has a problem with anger, or a woman has some kind of personality quirk, and they go through their life, and they struggle in relationships, they may struggle in their jobs, they may battle in the role of parenting, and a lot of it comes from the fact of not having any kind of voice of truth in their life. In other words, someone that, that can be brutally honest with them and help them to not only identify maybe some personality issues, but also, constructively begin to rebuild them.
So what kind of impact does this have on a church then?
Well, you know, a church, if you think about the church in many ways in our society is a voice of truth. Now, we're living in a day where a lot of people would like to silence that voice of truth on moral and ethical issues. And, you know, we're seeing the church in some ways pressured so much that it may want to tone down that confrontational voice. You know, prophets in the Old Testament were very confrontational. You know, Jesus was confrontational. If you look at John chapter 6, he started out with a mega church, and by the end of it, he was asking his disciples, would they also leave? and the reason being is because he, you know, much of what he was saying was difficult for people to be able to handle, but it was truth. And Jack Canfield wrote a book. I quote it in Killing the Church, but it's called The Success Principles. And in this, he does a lot of speaking, a lot of in the corporate world. And what he does at one point in a conference is he'll take an individual out of the conference setting, a volunteer. He'll say this person represents my goal, a particular goal in his life. Then he'll put them out in the room somewhere while he's also blindfolded. So Jack Canfield is blindfolded. He'll tell the volunteer, he'll say, now I'm going to navigate around through this room and try to reach you. And you either will say on course or off course. So here's Jack Canfield, he's blindfolded. Here's this volunteer who represents a goal in his life. And as Jack Canfield begins to move around through the room, the volunteer's either saying on course or off course. At the end of it, when he reaches the volunteer, he looks at the conference setting and he says, what did I hear most, or what did we hear most, on course or off course? And, of course, everybody says off course. He said, yes, the bulk of what I was hearing was negative, but I was making my way and ultimately achieving my goal, getting to my goal. And he went on to say that the problem is a lot of times in our life, we never achieve goals. We never get to where we really would like to be, where we'd like to go, because we don't incorporate into our lives voices of truth, those people that will give us honest dialogue and feedback.
All right, so in your book, do you address the people who should be giving that kind of feedback to a person, as opposed to a lot of times people who just they love to quote unquote speak the truth in love and can actually be quite hurtful.
Yeah, and that's in the very beginning of the book. I open with a story, and the second paragraph simply says, if you're going to read 2.5 chapters of this book and then put it down and put it into practice, don't buy it. Please don't buy it, because you'll do an enormous amount of damage, you know. So what happens in this book, it's not simply equipping people to go out there and beat up other people by being very confrontational. It is giving people, I believe, the tools to be able to do it in a biblical way that in many ways is going to be very productive. It won't be counterproductive. But now at the same time, Brian, the reality is that if you look at a pastor, there's a chapter, you know, where I deal with a pastor. A pastor is a person of confrontation. I heard Dr. Ron Herod, who pastored First Baptist Church Kenner for years in Louisiana. He made this statement one time to a bunch of us preacher boys back when I was in seminary. He said, when people come to church, he said, they ought to either be mad, sad, or glad. And he said, the danger is for people to come and be nothing.
Hmm.
Well, what he's saying is that a pastor, it to a degree, will be somewhat confrontational. That's normal. That's a part of it. You know, John the Baptist was that way in the Jordan. And, so, you know, I'm not only talking to the pastor, but it also equips laity to realize how valuable this asset can be. Now, it's not just simply teaching people how to be a voice of truth. It's also teaching people how to incorporate some friendships or peers or fellow believers who will be a voice of truth in their life.
Do you think that the fact that we don't have a lot of these kind of people in our lives nowadays is largely because they don't want to be in confrontation, or is it they just don't want to be invested in people?
Well, you know, first of all, we're getting more and more isolated, you know, from the fellowship of other people. You know, that's part of it. But, you know, Brian, there's a part of us, we want to be liked. You know, there's a statement in the book, would you be willing to risk a friendship for the sake of something, a truth that might change their life? In other words, would you be willing to forfeit a friendship because you saw this friend doing something that was so damaging that you had to say something, but you realize that it would probably end the friendship? Now, you know, that's a good question. You know, sometimes we want to be liked, and we want to be accepted. And so if you tell people what they want to hear, short term, yeah, there's acceptance, there's approval, they want you around. But sometimes, you know, you can say something that's honest and true that needs to be said to a family member, to a spouse, to somebody you love. At first they're angry, they pull away from you, but later on they come back and they say, you know, I just have to tell you, you were right. And, boy, that's a great, you know, I use the example, I was doing an interview down in Tampa in a program down there, and it's a women's type TV program, and I made this statement. I said, if my wife buys a dress, and it's just absolutely atrocious, it's just ugly, but yet she believes she looks good in it, and I know she doesn't. I know her style. I've been married 36 years. When she comes in and says, how do I look? We're getting ready to go to church. How do I look? In that moment, I'm faced with a real crisis. If I say, you look nice, I think you look beautiful, then the reality is she may go on to church. People are whispering in the hallway saying, you know, did you see the pastor's wife? That dress looks ridiculous. And they're all laughing behind her back. And yet when they look at her face to face, they'll say, hey, yeah, you look real nice. You know, well, they're lying. Now, the other side of it is I can tell her the truth. She gets hurt. She cries. She goes and changes clothes. She sulks and everything else. But then later on, maybe a day or two later, she tries it on in front of one of my grown daughters, and they say, Mom, that dress looks horrible. Dad was right. You know. sometimes we have to love people enough to tell them the truth, even at the risk of the discomfort it may bring us. I think this is the problem today in America. I think one of the biggest problems in America, and I have pastors say this all the time, I want to be liked. You know, I want approval. I want the congregation to like me. And hey, let's face it. You know, the Bible said, Paul said, in the last days they'll heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. And basically, pastors are tempted as much as anyone to be accepted, to find approval, and, you know, and there's a great cost to that sometimes, even to the church.
Dr. Parker, do you deal in your book at all with the hardest confrontation of all, and that is the confrontation involving church discipline?
Yes, yes. And, you know, if you think about it, and we've just about completely moved away from it, but the reality is that confrontation is the front line of discipline. You can never have discipline until you first have confrontation. And so if you don't get this first step right, you're going to fail in discipline. So being able to approach somebody, even in, you know, I use examples such as you know, you're in a work environment, you see a relationship between someone you value their friendship with someone else in that environment, in that workplace, and you have to approach that person. Well, how do you do it? You know, a lot of times people say, well, you know, and I deal with this. Well, you know, what right do I have to invade somebody else's life and to do that? Well, if it's a professing Christian, if you're working in, let's say you work at a bank and, you know, you see a friend who begins to, you know, he's spending a lot of time with a young lady, a teller, you know, it's very noticeable. Other people are beginning to notice it. And you finally say, man, I've got to pull my buddy off to the side because this is not looking good. He's married. He's got three kids. Man, the cost of this, you know, and you approach this individual, you know, if he's a professing Christian, then you have every right to say to him, you know, he may say, well, what right do you have? Well, first of all, you know, you're a friend, but beyond that, you profess to be a fellow Christian in this office. If you fail here, you not only affect your credibility, you affect mine, you affect the church you're a part of, and ultimately you affect Christ and the Great Commission. And I think this is the problem. We are uncomfortable with it. We don't like to do this. And yet it is critical if church discipline is ever to take place.
For those who would
Brian, a lot of this could be done by the individual laity, by the individual layperson, and not even come to the point. You know, if you look at Matthew 18:15-19, Jesus said, look, one-on-one, go to your brother, you know, speak to your brother. You know, before it ever, you know, we talk about church discipline, but the first two stages of that was quiet confrontation, trying to bring a person to repentance. The guy at the bank may look at his friend, he may get mad a day or two later. He says, you know, I went home, I sat around the table, my wife and my three kids, I looked at my kids, I looked at my wife, and I thought, my God, what am I doing? He hugs your neck the next day at work, and he says, man, thank you. He goes to the teller and says, listen, I'm sorry. I probably was coming across in a way that just wasn't right. I want to ask you to forgive me. Now look at the testimony of the integrity and the credibility of Christianity within that workplace when that happens.
Absolutely.
You know.
So the person who would read this book, Killing the Church, The Failure to Confront, what is it that you ultimately want readers to take away from your writing?
Well, first of all, I want people to see that it is a very natural element of the church. You know, worship's confrontational, preaching's confrontational, you know, the Bible, you know, the Bible's a very confrontational book. It convicts. You know, it cuts us under. as the writer of Hebrews says, you know. So, you know, there, to me, first of all, people would be able to read this book and say, you know, this is not something that I have to be afraid of. This is something that ought to be natural. It ought to be just a part of the church, part of the body of Christ. It is the process by which we are kept from having to do church discipline. If we do this well, then we will solve probably 95% of our church discipline issues. And also to teach people that, hey, I don't have to be afraid of this. Let me find some friendships, some peers. Let me begin to incorporate into my life some people that can look at me and say, hey, I love you, but you're off course.
Very good. Where can we find the book, Killing the Church, The Failure to Confront?
Well, you can get it through Westbow Press, Amazon, and it is an ebook form too, so you can get it through Amazon on ebook as well. I really encourage people to buy it, especially for pastors and church leaders. And over and over again, I've had pastors that have said life changing. So they dog-eared every page, they were highlighting. I had a Fulbert Colonel chaplain said, "Man, I wish I'd have had this 30 years ago." I had a retired pastor who literally wept. He said, "I wish I'd have had this book a long time ago." And he even made this statement. He said, "I just wept and cried God before God and repented for a ministry that I've had for the last 34 years."
Very profound. Do you have any website or social media or ways that people can contact you?
Well, one of the good things people can do is just simply go to our church website, and that's ssbaptistchurch.com.
Very good.
Just ssbaptistchurch.com, and there they can find everything from the book to a blog to, you know, everything they would need to know.
Outstanding. The name of the book again, Killing the Church, The Failure to Confront. Dr. Jeff Parker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. It's been an honor.
Enjoyed talking to you, sir. Best of luck with the book. I'm Brian Houston. This is Indie Book Publishing, brought to you by Westbow Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Adam, John, Peter, A Journey. And the author is Van Hunter. And Van joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Van.
Hey, Steve. How are you doing?
Great to have you with us. This special book, Adam, one of your grandsons, he's the main character. You know, as you put it, he travels through time and space on a mystical tour of suffering and great joy. And he finds out a lot about himself and his relationship to his Savior. And it's a great, great inspirational book.
Yeah, I think so. And that was the reason that I wrote it. I wanted to help bring, to lift other people up and bring them into the faith. That's the whole thing for me. I just want people to realize that Jesus is there, the door is open, he is knocking, and all you have to do is answer.
Now, you know a bit, as you talk about suffering in this book, what Adam goes through, but you know personally about suffering because of your battle with leukemia.
Yes. I had leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. I suffered a lot, but I never everybody said, well, you never complained. And I said, well, I didn't, because it was, I don't know, I knew that it was God was working with me in some way. But, so, yes, I did suffer a lot, but I offered all of that suffering up to our Lord and, you know, through the cross.
Well, you called it a spiritual wake-up call. That's quite a, you know, phrase to describe cancer.
Yes, it was, actually, because up until that point, I had drifted away from the faith. I'd been in the Marine Corps. Flying fighters, and I thought that everything I did was what I did, and I didn't think that anybody else had a hand in it. It was all because of me. So I think at some point, when I got the cancer, when it all when I started to come back to the faith, it was as if God had hit me over the head with a 2x4 and said, wake up, son, I got some stuff I want you to do.
Right, right.
And so that's what I've been doing, and this book is one of those things.
Now, you were staring out a window and you saw a face at the top of a palm tree.
That's true. I was down in Trent, or actually, where was it? Casa Grande, at a resort there, and I was laying on the couch on the bus, and I was looking out the window, and I saw what looked like a face on the palm tree. And that's what initiated the whole story, because I was trying to think. I wanted to write something, but I didn't know what I was going to write. And it was like, you know, that was sort of a gift for me to see that face on there. And so that's how the whole story started. And everything just kind of fell into around that.
So, Adam, how old is Adam?
At the time, he was 10 years old.
So, the time of the story, he's 10 years old, and he's with his family, and they're going to go off on a cruise.
Yes, that's true. And they do go on a cruise, and, of course, disaster strikes, and there's a giant tsunami, 1,000-foot tsunami, and a lot of people get washed overboard, Adam being one of them, and he ends up on an island, and he's separated from his family. And the reason that I wanted to separate Adam from the ship was the ship represents the secular world and all its distractions. And so I wanted to take Adam away from the ship and put him by himself on an island so we could talk about, you know, we could talk about the faith and everything. I really saw the ship as representing the secular world, all the material things that we chase after, and how that distracts us from the truth.
So from this incredible event, Adam ends up alone on this island, a very young boy, all alone, to have to face his fears and to survive.
Yes. And it's, some of it's humorous, some of it's not. There's one part where Adam has a parrot land on his shoulder, and Adam's been sitting there wondering what he's going to eat, and this parrot comes and lands on his shoulder and talks into his ear. It's, of course, it's a messenger from God. And the parrot says, Adam, the pizza delivery boy is not coming. Pick up a stick, sharpen it, and take it to the shore. And there on the shore, he finds at low tide all these crabs that are out there, and he harvests a bunch of crabs and cooks them. And he still hadn't realized what was going on. And then all of a sudden, he realized, hey, you know, my prayer was answered. So, he had quite a feast with the crabs.
Why do so many people find God unnecessary?
I think it's a hard thing. I think it's difficult for people to understand that, I think. And that's a hard question, by the way. But it is difficult for people to accept that. I don't know. It's like there's right. so many distractions in this world today, you know, video right. games, TV, all those things. And it just, you know, God seems like an inconvenience almost when he's not. I mean, it's there's such a joy in Jesus Christ that is, I can't explain it until you know it. And
right.
And once you do, it changes your life.
Well, you have to try the experiment. You just can't go by what others say. You have to do it yourself.
Absolutely.
I heard a person say, you know, if you don't put God first, there's really no place for him. He doesn't fit in anywhere else.
I like that. I like that a lot because he should come first. Should be God, your family, and then maybe somebody else, and then you, you know. So if you have to put those things first and, you know, to really live a full life.
I think we can all identify somewhat with your story. Here's Adam all alone in this island. Obviously, now Adam has to, as we've already mentioned, has to face his greatest fears. One of the fears of children and many adults is to deal with the darkness. You know, how did Adam deal with that? And why do we fear the darkness?
I don't know why. Well, if you look at that in the sense of the darkness being the void, that's what I call it, the void. The void is the total absence of God, and that's kind of my view of what hell might be like. Of course, I don't know, but I see the total absence of God being something that is horrific and scary, the scariest thing that I could even imagine. Because that you would be floating in a dark void. What could be worse than that for eternity? So, but that was my view, and I know other people wouldn't agree with it, but it is just a view, because we don't know what hell would be like. We have no idea. We really have no idea what heaven would be like. We have some ideas, but I think I'd rather go to heaven than hell.
Right. Well, that's. I think we all want to believe that. We want to go to heaven and not hell. How does Adam, Adam, does he learn how to pray? Is this something that, you know, that he, I mean, as a young boy?
Yeah, when he was, in reality, and Adam is a real kid, he went through RCI, religious Catholic instruction, and he learned to pray there. But I don't think any of that stuff really stuck with him in reality. So on the island, he learns to pray. He says, Lord, he said, if you're there, I can't remember the exact words in the book, but if you're there, please answer my prayer. I'm hungry. I need food. And he didn't realize till after words that God had answered his prayer. And so that's when he really learned to pray, and he started taking it all seriously.
Yeah, God, don't worry about it. I found all these crabs on the beach. So, you know, I'm taken care of.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And he had this feast of these crabs, and he went back and took them back to his camp and cooked them on the fire and you know, where they had a feast. And then at the end of the feast, he goes, oh, my God, he answered my prayer.
Right. Now, and, now here's a real tough question, one that you posed. This is the question that you wrote that in your questionnaire. You said, why Jesus and not Buddha or Muhammad or Gandhi?
Okay, Jesus was the only person of all those people. I mean, Jesus came to earth and said, I am God. Buddha didn't say that. He said, I have a way. Gandhi didn't say that. He just said, I have a way to follow. Muhammad said, I have a way. But Jesus was the only person to say, I am God. And I believe that he is God.
Now, one of the themes in your book deals with our country and the lack of leadership in spiritual things.
I think this country has really drifted away, and I think we might be in trouble. We've got to get back to God. You can't take God out of the Pledge of Allegiance. You can't, take "In God We Trust" off the coins or the money. I mean, we have to keep that going. We have to keep God alive in our society. If we let that go, I don't know. I don't know how you're going to live.
Right.
I mean, you'll live, but I don't know. I don't think there's any salvation there.
So as we get back to the storyline of the book titled Adam, John, Peter, A Journey, this journey really literally goes through time and space to find Jesus, and strange and scary things happen to Adam.
Yes, they do. I think, the biggest scary thing for Adam was being in the dark. That just scared him terribly. And then God, when you read the book, you'll see that God provided him light in the darkness by lightning striking a tree and starting a fire, and that's where Adam's spirits were lifted because he had the light of the faith at that point, or at least it was there and he was seeing it. But once he had that fire and he was out of the darkness, that's when he started to grow in his faith.
Do you believe in angels?
I do. I believe we all have a guardian angel. I think they're among us. I think they're there.
Very reassuring that we're not alone, and that's what I'm sure Adam comes to realize. Even on this island where he is shipwrecked, so to speak, just trying to survive, he's not alone.
No, he's not alone. And that's what he discovers. And as you get toward the end of the story there, you'll see that he really comes into the faith. And actually, in the book and in the story, he meets Jesus face to face. And that's the one thing that Jesus says to him. He said, I can see your faith is strong. And that's when he gets to go back to his family.
We've been listening to Van Hunter. He is the author of his book, Adam, John, Peter, A Journey. Interesting title. That certainly has a biblical ring.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
And this is one of your grandsons who you used just as the main character in your book.
Yes, I did. And simply because, I mean, look at his name, and Adam, John, Peter. It's so biblical. So that's why I chose him.
How do we get? What's the best way to get your book, Van?
Well, if you look, I sent you an email there, and it says you can go to numericalproductions.com, and if you go to that address and buy the book there, I will send you a signed copy. You can also get it through Amazon.com. Or you can get it from Westville Press by going to vanhunterauthor.com. And those are the three ways I know right now. There's probably other ways.
Very, very good. Yes. I did receive the email, so I just read it. So great to have you with us, Van, on Indie Book Publishing.
Hey, Steve, be sure to forward that message I sent you.
I'll do it.
Okay. Thank you.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Westbow Press.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.